This is Mark Strassman, technology reporter at Tech News on cellcast.biz. We're about to talk to Paul Kirchhoff, who is the vice president for business development at United Devices in Austin, Texas. Computing Day. Welcome to Tech News on cellcast.biz.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you define for our first-time listeners what is grid computing?
Well, the way that we identify grid computing here, being the software company that makes or enables grid computing, is the sharing of both dedicated and non-dedicated resources in the compute IT environment. So that means sharing storage across multiple different systems and locations and departments. Same thing with CPU usage. So it's really taking an entirely heterogeneous environment and making it look like a single machine.
Right, so essentially you're creating one big giant computer.
That's exactly right. We sometimes call it a virtual supercomputer.
Right, a virtual supercomputer. What is a traditional supercomputer?
Well, traditionally supercomputers have been, number one, very, very expensive. They're a single machine with many, many processors and a memory structure that allows the applications that run on them to intercommunicate between these processors and memory very, very quickly. And so when you talk about making the jump from traditional supercomputers to virtual supercomputers, there's a couple of big differences.
Okay, what are they?
Well, there are some applications, for example, that are run on a very tightly coupled environment like a supercomputer that, frankly, are not a good fit for a widespread virtual supercomputer or a grid environment. And those are really applications where the individual processing elements that are happening between all of the processors inside of a supercomputer need to talk to each other very, very quickly because their next calculation relies on somebody else's calculation. So you can imagine that if you have a grid that has PCs connected through various mechanisms, some are on dial-up, some are on a T1, and they're located all over the world, if one of those nodes fails, or jumps off of the network, you could find yourself in a situation where not only is it slow even if they're all connected, but if one stops, then everybody else stops.
So, in fact, some problems are more suitable for grid computing because the elements, the parts of the process can sort of carry on their own a little bit more. Whereas when they're dependent on other calculations that are being made at other nodes, it doesn't work as well.
Well, I think that's a true statement, but the one caveat is that there's a continuum of these things.
Right.
So there are some things like weather modeling, for example, where there's so many different elements, humidity, pressure, wind, lots of different things that come into weather or climate modeling that you really do need a supercomputing type of infrastructure. On the other end of the spectrum, there are things like grid computing where at the furthest definition is kind of a hub and spoke model. So what happens is you take a big piece of data and an algorithm that needs to do something with that, and you send a copy of the algorithm and a little chunk of that data down to a node. It does its work and it sends it back and you recompile it.
Right.
In between, there is a continuum of applications that are very applicable for being distributed a la grid, but still need some degree of fast interconnectivity from a bandwidth perspective. And frankly, that's where the world of clusters have found their niche. These are distributable individual machines and nodes, but they are connected by some level of connectivity that's significant, but not necessarily on the back plane of a motherboard like a supercomputer maybe.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the origins of grid computing. I was thinking about it in the mid-80s. I was involved for a brief period of time with some products from Intel that called themselves concurrent computers.
Mm-hmm.
And when I've started reading about grid computing, it sounded to me like it was kind of the same parallel architecture, but distributed over a wider geographical area. Was there some connection between that concurrent computing model and what now exists as grid computing?
Well, number one, I'm sure there is, because the entire computing infrastructure has all grown up from a couple of singular points. But I think that what the interesting thing is that people's vision for parallel computing has certainly been there ever since probably humans thought of queuing different elements of queuing theory, right?
Right.
And kind of, you know, lining up two people to check you out instead of one with a long line.
Right.
So so that I think that has grown from long, probably even before concurrent computing from Intel. But the interesting thing is what happens when you actually try to solve it, which is where we are, because what you find is that it's, even if you're using a cluster and you are and you have let's say 16 servers on a rack in your department, there's a whole set of things you have to consider when you decide to not only use that resource but to use five other clusters and your company's 50,000 PCs as a virtual supercomputer. One of them is security, for example. In a cluster or in a supercomputer, you're pretty much assured that the data is not going anywhere because, frankly, nobody on the outside of the network can see all of the nodes and get to them anyway. They're just hidden from visible IP addresses.
Right.
But in a true grid environment, everything is not only visible, but things can jump on and off the network. People can shut off their machines. Right. You don't have that problem in a dedicated environment. A portable can check off and not come back in for 90 days. And the other primary difference is that somebody may be using that machine for its primary purchase reason. So, for example, I mean, one of the things that we do is we use salespeople, administrators, PCs, when their fingers are off of the keyboard, we're using the rest of that CPU cycle and maxing it out to do high-performance computing in the background. But when they move the mouse, they need to know that or they need to never know that work is being done.
Right, so there's a trade-off there. You want to make sure you're using as many cycles as you can, but you don't want to interfere with the friendly use of the computer for its primary user.
Yeah, that's right. So the three things that really define a, you know, heterogeneous grid at the maximum level of that definition is security becomes very important because that's a problem you typically don't have to think about when you're in a dedicated environment.
Right.
Second one is unobtrusiveness. That means making sure that whatever the primary reason for buying that box remains intact and it never knows that you're using it for a secondary function like high-performance computing.
Right.
And then the third one is scalability.
Right.
Having a piece of software that can manage things jumping on and off at the level of 2 million machines connected to it.
Right.
So those are three things that, you know, people in traditional high-performance computing have never had to solve, and that's what we do.
Okay. Just a few little items here. Is it possible to say in a series of typical environments how much processing power is going unused at any one time? For example, I'm sitting here in front of my computer right now, and I'm encoding our conversation.
Right.
In fact, it says here manual encoding CPU use 20% and an average of 21%. That's about what it is when I do these recordings. Although it sometimes jumps up into the 30s. And this is a pretty high intensity use, it seems to me, of my CPU.
That's right. I mean, the average person that does nothing more than Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And I'm talking like a sales and marketing person, an operations person, maybe an administrator, maybe gets to 5%.
Really?
The rest of it is completely idle. I mean, what you're doing right now is a pretty heavy-duty processing-intensive application. And if it's only at 20%, which obviously you can check.
I can check, right.
Then you realize that, you know, for a long, long time, people have continued to overbuy in terms of processing requirements. And under normal circumstances, that seems like a really ridiculous thing because, for example, in the real estate world, you know, how many people, who would stay in business if you built a 10-story building and only rented out 3 stories and then you got ready to go build another or buy another 10-story building? I mean, you'd run out of business quickly. So what grid computing does is it says, listen, we know you already bought the 10-story building. We know you're only using 3 stories of it, but we have a way to make use of the other 7 stories.
So in a way, you're harvesting all of this unused capacity.
Absolutely.
Now, and that presumably gives you enough leeway that you can get a good deal of processing from it without impinging on the normal use of the system.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. If you were a CIO or or even a CTO in a federal agency, for example, I mean, at some point, assuming the applications are are equal no matter what architecture you're running them on, you've got to make a decision. And that decision is, I can either go buy the equivalent of, let's say, $50 million worth of new hardware to expand to for my expansion and get, let's say, you know, three to five teraflops worth of extra power, or I can look at the unused cycle of PCs, servers, and workstations underneath my nose, turn on 100 teraflops at a tenth of the cost. Grid computing is a truly disruptive technology, but I think the question that people have to ask is, who is it disruptive to? It's certainly not disruptive to the customer, because, you know, anytime you can turn on, you know, 100x the speed and power at one-tenth of the cost of what you were going to do, is pretty powerful.
Okay, tell people what a teraflop is and what it means in practical terms.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think of the best way to turn this on or to explain this. Let me give you an example. The on-demand, we operate an on-demand grid service where people who don't have 7,000 machines sitting underneath their nose to turn into a grid can come rent time on somebody else's 7,000
right.
CPU machines.
And presumably the people who have the extra capacity are getting paid by you a certain amount to provide it.
Yeah, or they're just trying to make dollars on their excess capacity as
right.
well. So the specific example is Gateway. Gateway Computer Corporation has 270 stores all across the country. All of those things have high-end PCs sitting in them that are just demos. I mean, nobody uses them. They just come and, you know, maybe touch the keyboard and mouse. So what happens is, while they're not being used, our software has strung them all together in a virtual supercomputer, and other companies that would normally need to rent time or buy a supercomputer now just come and rent time on this virtual supercomputer.
So you're essentially a broker for compute cycles.
That's right. I mean, in a sense, it's using PC architecture in Gateway's situation to compete with supercomputers that would rent time as well, and we're just the catalyst that makes it all happen.
Now, for a typical enterprise that has a lot of PCs sitting around on desks, the issue seemed to me, as we're going along here, that if they put all that extra capacity to use, they don't have anything to do with it, do they? Or besides maybe rent it out to you to rent out to other people? Or how does that work?
I think it depends on the verticals that you talk about. So, for example, you know, I'll tell you, a side thing is to consider this. Anybody who is using clusters anywhere in any company has a potential use of a grid.
What is a cluster exactly?
So a cluster in today's world is, you know, anywhere from, I mean, it can be as low as 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 servers that are all connected with software similar to ours but without the grid, you know, security and the unobtrusiveness features that I talked about.
Right.
That connects them together in kind of a mini-grid
right.
standpoint, right?
Right.
And so what's happening is anybody who has an application that's being distributed amongst this department cluster, departmental, you know, mini-grid,
right.
can easily benefit by expanding that distributed environment to include everything. And you're right. In some cases, you know, there may be a company that only has one or two applications and they just would never use the amount of power that's sitting underneath their nose, in which case they can either just say it's not a fit, or they can say, well, how else can I take advantage of this extra power?
Right.
But in many, many verticals, financial services has huge modeling bottlenecks where, you know, if they can take it, the more variables they can take into account in a given scenario, the tighter their degree of confidence comes out the other end. The pharmaceutical guys are slamming together cancer targets and huge libraries of virtual molecules to see if they bind with each other.
Right.
The oil and gas world is running reservoir simulations to try to figure out what the right angle is to drill into a bizarre, you know, looking gas well. So,
and there are all the weather applications.
Yeah, the weather guys. I mean, there's an enormous amount. Anything that does Monte Carlo simulations. So, I mean, we have people that are looking at semiconductor verification testing software where they're running a ton of different scenarios on their design to figure out where the flaws are. Anything with financial risk. I'm trying to think of some more. In the government space, we have several intelligence areas that are using this for you know, there's language translation, there's text and data mining, huge searching. So you can think, just like Google, what happens is I believe they're using a little bit of grid technology, but searching huge amounts of text or anything is perfect for a grid, because what happens is you take the search algorithm with the inputs that you're searching for, and you take a little chunk of the available field data that you need to look for, and you send it down to a node, and you send the next chunk of data with the same search query down to the next node. So the amount of nodes you can have directly attacks the problem at hand.
So the idea is that there's plenty of work to be done in the computing area now that these systems can do.
There is. One indication is anywhere there's a cluster, there's an opportunity for significant benefit from a grid, and there's many, many places in the government and all over the commercial industries as well. I mean, I don't think there are many. We actually have a customer right now that is that's starting to apply sales and marketing, data mining, data translation applications using a grid, and they're the types of benefits that companies get versus using clusters or their other traditional architectures are enormous. And we're talking about taking simulation runs or whatever application work that they're doing and changing it from months to hours.
Can these systems work effectively to do things like rendering of animation?
Absolutely. That's another perfect example in the entertainment world. We don't specifically have a customer that's actively doing that right now. We're in discussions with two or three of them, but that is the application that is in question. And frankly, what they're looking at doing is they're looking at moving from a very expensive cluster architecture where, if they want a little bit more power, they have to go buy another server or another cluster, and yet they're sitting on top of 1,000 PCs that are only being used 5%. So that's like adding 1,000 nodes.
So, in fact, the reason this can work, of course, is because a gate is a gate, and a binary digit is a binary digit, and all of these applications, animation, intelligence mining, or business modeling, all resolve themselves essentially to cycles on the opening and closing of small electronic gates.
That's true. I mean, that's exactly right. As long as the data can be separated and sent out with the algorithm, then that's really the core requirement for whether or not something can be used on a grid. And then the only question becomes, do those nodes or work units that get sent out to the individual nodes, do they rely on each other? Do they need to cross-communicate? And if they do, that's okay, because our software can make that happen. But if that requirement is there, then the question is, what does the bandwidth look like through which these are going to talk to each other? Because if it's too slow, then maybe the overall benefit of those runs versus leaving it on a tightly coupled environment may not be there.
So, of course, all of this improves exponentially when bandwidth increases as a general proposition.
Say that one more time, I'm sorry.
The creation of more broadband connections between and among institutions and individual users makes all of this work even better then.
That's true. I think that's true to a certain extent. If you have a job run where the level of computation is way, way, way higher than the need for bandwidth, then it's less important.
Right.
But if you run into these tightly coupled applications that require, they can't move until they get each other's results from each step, then you're right. I mean, the faster the connectivity is between them, the faster the job will get done.
Exactly. Talk about United Devices, where it came from, what it does, what its products are, and so on.
United Devices has a very interesting background. The management team from the business side is mostly from the computing industry. So we have guys that are from Dell, IBM, Microsoft, and Intel. From the technical side, some of the guys that originally started SETI at Home, which was a huge distributed computing out on the open internet endeavor. Some of the original guys that started that helped start the technical side of United Devices. So the grid piece and distributing on a large scale The reason we're so good at it is because we had some of the original folks that did that.
That SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
That's right.
And they essentially set up a volunteer effort where people could use their extra cycles to analyze incoming radio signals from space to figure out whether they were little green persons or what.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The difference between what SETI at home did and what we ultimately do out on a big public grid, which I'll talk about in a second, is that we have basically an operating system so that you can bring any type of application, not just one looking for the little green men, onto this massive public grid. But I'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
The other piece of the technical team was a group of developers from an entity called Distributed.net. And these guys also used distributed computing. I think at one point they probably had several hundred thousand systems connected to win the decryption challenges that came out from the RSA. So these guys would put a new encryption algorithm together. The government, they'd throw it out there and they'd say, all right, we want to have a contest to see who can break it. And these guys would win every time because they were running their decryption algorithms on as many nodes as possible. So
right.
They'd break it and they'd do it faster than anybody. And that's why security is so tight in what we do as well.
So you've got code breakers and extraterrestrial seekers, sort
that's
of
right.
Your origins.
Yeah, that's a good right. Way of looking at it.
Okay, and so when did they get together? When was UD Devices organized?
So United Devices was founded in 1999. It's about 4 years old.
Right.
And you know, the traditional industries where this company is pretty strong is life science, but we also do things in the government space.
This is Mark Sussman, reporter with
Real World,
about to speak to a very influential people at Intel Corporation about grid computing.
And because of the wave from grid computing, we're seeing interest from
projects are
car
going,
and airplane manufacturers
is delivering on
who have applications
seems,
that you know like
pretty enormous
on
right now. So
and they want to take
thanks
the next
very much
step,
for your help and
as well
for your information, and good luck with your work.
And then there's a myriad of other industries.
Well,
I'll talk about entertainment and the semiconductor
within
world.
Minutes.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. So go ahead.
I was going to say, but we do things.
Thank
we
you
do some things
all
that are pretty interesting and different than anybody else. Period out there.
Like
one of them is that we sell our software as an enterprise piece of software. So Novartis, for example, is a customer of ours. They have a grid that's in the several thousand node size, but have openly said in the press that this year they expect to expand to all 60,000 to 70,000. Machines. So these are guys who are seeing the benefit and are really one of the lead adopters that are out there. So we sell things as an enterprise piece of software. We have the on-demand service, which is also unique, especially given the architecture with Gateway. And then we also operate what we believe is the world's largest public general-purpose research grid. So if you go to grid.org, that's where we operate the ability for somebody to come and download the piece of software, which is a screensaver, just like you would have done at SETI at home. And what happens is you can sign up for a couple of grand-scale projects, whichever one appeals to you. We're doing one looking for a cure for cancer, and we're doing another one looking for a cure for smallpox.
So some of these are done kind of on an altruistic volunteer basis, and some of them are done for money, or how does that work?
Yeah, the first two that I described are really, you know, profit centers, and the other one is kind of a good for humanity type of business that we run.
So can individual people or small companies or big companies who don't really have a need for more processing and have a lot of excess capacity, they can either contribute their cycles through you, or can they sell their cycles to you or rent them, or however you want to put it?
Well, this is so the size of the global grid that
right.
we operate is 2.5 million machines.
Right.
The benefit that United Devices gets out of that is really just an enormous proving ground for scalability and security, because you're operating, you know, real molecules flying back and forth in pretty much every country and territory on Earth, and people try to hack all the time, and we've never really had any breaches. But so it's really, that's the benefit that we get. If people have extra capacity, really they have two choices. They can contact us and say, hey, I've got a lot of extra capacity. Can you help me, if I don't have a use for it myself, which obviously we can help them figure out, can you help me do something with it? And doing something with it is just a question of you know, do they have the wherewithal, and that's a big nebulous word, to actually make it into a profit center and to market it, but certainly our software can enable that to happen. Or the other thing they can do is they can go to grid.org and download agents onto all their machines and contribute their processing power to these good for humanity projects. And we have a lot of companies. I mean, pretty much every company or government agency we walk into, eventually, if you meet the high performance guys, they'll tell you they've been, you know, they show us the screensaver on their system. So while we're sitting there talking about a commercial adoption, their PC is cranking on a cure for smallpox.
So would it be right to say, go ahead.
That's okay, go ahead.
Would it be right then to say that you're trying to evangelize as much as you can to get people to add their cycles to your pot, and that you're either going to use it for altruistic purposes or sell it or both?
No, really, the like I said, those three pillars, the enterprise piece, you know, we help people use their own assets. The on-demand piece is really done only with Gateway, and we say, if you need lots of compute power but don't own it or have it at your disposal, you can rent time on this. The global piece is totally altruistic at this point. So if somebody wants to use extra capacity and doesn't know what else to do with it, they can certainly contribute their processing power to this totally for free, non-profit, you know, good for humanity research projects. The only one scenario that doesn't fit any of those three is the guy that comes and says, I own a lot of PCs. I don't necessarily want to just contribute them to the smallpox or cancer research project. I would like to make money on these. Then what happens is we would get in a conversation with them, just like we did with Gateway, saying, okay, if you use our software, we can make your PC time rentable.
Right.
And then the question is, you know, can you market it? How, you know, is there enough demand out there? There's a lot of other questions behind that.
So, and are you in that business of helping individuals or collectivities aggregate and market their extra cycles?
Yeah, I mean, we actually have a product that's the software plus a little bit of professional services. I think the name of it right now is called Grid MP Alliance. And it's meant for, you know, those folks like CompUSA or Best Buy that have PCs just sitting there all over the place that want to do something with them.
Let's say the people of Los Angeles or the people of California, seeing that their government is $10 billion in the red, wants to help out the government by providing cycles for it. There are millions of computers in California, millions of them in Los Angeles.
Right.
Would that be feasible?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the other thing that we've done in the past is made mini global grids for other people. So, for example, NTT Data in Japan is a partner of ours, and they came to us and they said, listen, we really like this amazing thing you guys have done with all these countries, all these volunteers looking for cancer. We'd like to build a Japan global grid, a la a California kind of a California grid.
And all the California grid I just mentioned.
Yeah, exactly, right. And it's the same exact situation. All it would take is the government, you know, officials to say, you know what, we want to include and incorporate all of these people into a grid, and then it's just, you know, it's what would happen is we'd set up the same type of infrastructure that we have for the global grid here, in which case all the Californians can go to a specific government website or wherever it is, and they download an agent, and that agent basically controls the interaction between their machine and the servers that would be sitting, you know, somewhere else in California. And then the government officials could do some great things with it. I mean, one of the things they could do is they could go to all of the outstanding colleges and universities that are in California and say, California is going to lead the market in terms of science and technology. And all Californians will benefit from this because of the talent and the, you know, business that will come in. But the first step is for all the Californians to donate their extra PC cycle. It'll be totally non-intrusive. And what we will do is we'll go to all these great universities and we'll tell all of the different colleges that normally require high-performance computing, people that study finance, semiconductors, biotech, earthquake monitoring, whatever, and we'll help them get the applications up on this huge grid. And now there'll be plenty of horsepower. We won't have to fund huge compute budgets in the universities because California itself is a massive computer.
Because
yes, enormous benefits.
Because in fact, what Caltech is doing with seismology and what Stanford is doing with high energy particle physics are just two examples of what's going on in California that use supercomputing capacity.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I guarantee you, if you went from college to college, there's probably thousands more apps. And all of them could run, and all of them could run very fast with very little extra investment on the taxpayer's behalf.
And you mean this hasn't been done yet?
Well, we really just haven't pushed that way because we have such a we're a medium-sized company and we're kind of filled up with national government and commercial stuff. But you know, certainly if there was somebody in the state government that wanted to create a state grid,
right?
And it's an enormous political advantage too, because what ends up happening is the screensaver that shows itself to all Californians can be used for great things. It can be used not only for positive, relations with taxpayers, but the other thing is it can also be used to communicate terrorist threat levels, anything.
Right. One or two other things, and then I'll let you get back to computing. I don't know whether United Devices was involved in it, but I've read recently that both Chinese universities and Indian universities have launched grid initiatives. Were you involved with that? What's happening with that, and what's kind of the global competitiveness picture on grid computing?
Well, I think, for the most part, the true enterprise adoption is happening faster in Europe than it is here in the U.S. Asia-Pacific region is probably tied neck and neck with the U.S. in terms of people adopting this architecture. From a university standpoint, there are people who are building what they call grids, and a lot of it depends on what they actually mean. Sometimes it's it's renting or laying down very fast connectivity, kind of VPN-like, between two universities, and then using cluster software to connect two clusters on either side so they can share them. And that is, to a certain degree, the definition of a grid. But we actually do have university clients that are connecting up all their computer labs into virtual supercomputers, but there's not a lot of sharing between universities such that all of one campus's clusters and PCs are shareable with another groups, clusters, and PCs. The technology that we have support can actually enable that, but I think most of these people are kind of talking lab to lab.
Right. Okay. Say a little bit of more reassurance about the two issues of security and essentially slowing down a system.
Yeah.
How that is very important. The security people don't want to. It seems like it would be a good place to put malicious code if you wanted to. How do you protect against that?
Well, from a security standpoint, we do several interesting things. Number one is we have all of the authentications for users as they enter the system. We also digitally sign all of the applications that get registered in the system, and that way you know that this application is, in fact, the same application, not a different application named, as the same application.
So in fact, participants can't be anonymous.
Yeah, participants can't be anonymous, and the applications that they check in not only have to have multiple signatures, but then it gets digitally signed itself. So wherever it goes in the system, the application itself is constantly authenticated.
Right.
And the other thing we do is once data is checked into the system, as soon as it gets checked in, it's encrypted and compressed, and the encryption we use is 168-bit triple DES, which is one of the highest levels of encryption you can have in a commercial environment.
Presumably things can be encrypted to a degree here that the only way you could ever possibly break it is by the system itself.
Yeah, you need a huge grid. That's exactly right. And what happens is even over the wire it stays encrypted, and then when it gets down to the actual node itself, it stays encrypted until the application and the grid software itself unencrypts it only to be used and then encrypts it again. And then every time we open and every time we reopen the data, we do things like checksums to look for digital tampering. So we make sure that the data was the same when we last left it from a signature standpoint. So there's a few other things that we do. I mean, if you talk about the global grid or the grid on the piece, we have biometric stuff around the data center and a concrete room with the application server. So there's all sorts of wacky things that we do. But for the most part, I think that's why we run a 2.5 million, node global grid with no security breaches, because we just, it's the one thing you just cannot sacrifice.
So pretty much it seems like it's safer on the grid than off the grid.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have had folks like IBM, Intel, and even some government agencies come do security audits on us And their takeaway was this is about 8 million times, you know, more secure than our own networks with all of the stuff that we put on it.
Okay, and what about the diminution of people's computing capacity on their own local systems?
You're talking about the unobtrusiveness?
Yes, unobtrusiveness.
Yeah, so unobtrusiveness is the other piece. What we do is when the agent goes out there with the data, it runs in its own sandbox is what we call it, which is a partition that is completely untouchable with the rest of the system, except for the fact that when the agent actually has a monitor on the system itself, and only when it is allowed from a priority level does it even act up. So, for example, there's different priority levels at which the operating system invokes certain processes, and what happens is things like moving the mouse or typing. You know, a small amount of idle time, those metrics are always set higher than the instantiation of activity using our software. What happens is it just sits there doing nothing until it realizes over a small amount of time, whatever that setting may be, that things have been idle, nobody's touching anything, everything else is at zero, I can act.
So before it walks into the living room to make sure that nobody's talking, and it can go in and be welcome.
That's exactly right. And the second it senses something else coming that's at a higher priority, it stops immediately.
So it's very polite.
Yeah, and you would never know it was there.
Intel and Oracle, how important are they in this space?
Those guys are always important in any space they get into. Intel was an original investor in this in United Devices.
So they figure more grid computing is good for them, huh?
Well, if you think about it, it makes sense because number one, Intel had not been a powerhouse in the high performance computing world. So by turning on investments that people have already been made, they suddenly become a high performance player, and they
right.
start to get applications and everybody off of these other things. But the other thing is, quite frankly, is that, you know, if you want to walk into corporate America or the big government agencies and try to convince somebody why their secretary needs a Pentium 8, one reason you need a Pentium 8 is not because that person's going to use 5%, it's because your other processes are going to use the other 100%.
So there's now a good reason to sell more powerful chips because they can be put to uses beyond what they normally would be.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Last words about the future of this, sort of in the near term and the long term. Where do you see grid computing going, and what role do you see United Devices playing in that?
Well, the interesting thing, I think, is that United Devices has built software already for where things are heading. So if you take a look at the way these applications that we've been talking about migrate, they've gone from supercomputers to SMP boxes with multiple processors, to clusters with multiple machines, and the next step should be using a ton of machines, right?
Right.
So it's kind of heading that way. I think where grid computing is going is there's going to be a blending of all of these architectures, and really grid computing should just, at the end of the day, be the glue that coordinates and manages this entire crazy architecture, no matter what's underneath the covers. And when somebody comes in and says, you know, my name is Joe, and, of course, Joe has a certain usage profile, the apps, the amount of bandwidth he takes up. When that guy checks in, the system should know, okay, Joe just checked in, rearranged things on the network for what he normally does, and the application that Joe uses is best matched to these three architectures. Two of them are being used, one of them isn't, so let's make sure that one stays free for the next microsecond. And really just kind of becoming an air traffic control system that manages all of these different architectures. The other interesting thing is that there is software that manages these clusters, and then there's software like ours that manages at a higher level all the widespread PCs with security and all the things that we've talked about. And I think there will become a blending of these capabilities so that a cluster that goes out the door that was intended originally to be in a dedicated environment where security and those things may not matter as much can suddenly, with the grid piece, be turned into the seed for a huge grid. And what happens then is that same cluster, when you need extra capacity, you just start sucking in all the PCs around you, and then eventually your neighbor's PCs, and suddenly your cluster that has needed more power has more power.
How is it determined who gets the cycles? If there's a power grid, right? On a hot summer day, everybody wants electricity. If everyone's playing massive multiplayer games and they're all using the grid, and somebody calls more power, more cycles. How's that going to work?
Well, it's a good question, and the interesting thing that plays into what we have built is you have to have a scheduling mechanism that supports various policies so that each user and each person that owns those resources has control over what gets shared. But really, if you have the intelligence in the scheduling engine and you have the ability to virtualize and provision in a way that is radically flexible and allows the people who own resources and the people that need the resources to communicate and coordinate without conflict, I mean, that's the difficult piece in this whole thing.
Right. Well, in fact, what you essentially have is, I think we were talking earlier, that there's essentially the altruistic grid and then there's the commercial grid. And on the altruistic grid, apparently you need some, you know, council of deciders to figure out who gets what's available. And on the commercial side, presumably you'd have a free market and people would bid for the cycles, right?
Yeah, that's possible. Absolutely.
Okay. Many science fiction writers in the 20th century, back in the 20th century, fantasized about a world computing grid, and mostly they were worried about it. Are you worried that there are threats to privacy or other kinds of problems that might arise out of this system, or is the system kind of structured so that that can't happen?
Well, you know, the point of vulnerability, I think, in any grid environment, even if you have all of the security aspects and the encryption and all the things that we've been talking about, the real point of vulnerability is really, you know, ultimately it comes down to human nature, because some human at some point has the OK button when they put something into the system. And, you know, there's really no way around that. And so, you know, ultimately, is there a chance that, you know, is there a chance that security could be hacked through? Well, there's always that level of issue, and that's why you have multi levels of security. But the real thing that is difficult for a software vendor to battle against is human nature, where a bad apple comes in one day, has all the authentications that they've been privileged to have, and then abuses it.
Right. Okay. Well, we're not going to be able to solve that problem today. Are you working towards? Is it technically feasible to create one world global grid eventually that includes all the computers in the world?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't see any reason technically why with the global grid that we have today that's not possible. So, you know, there are certainly a couple of things that we would need to support that maybe we don't support that would suck in, you know, somebody's remote flavor of a supercomputer and a couple of other things. But as long as the agent piece of our software could connect with a resource and look at it, understand what it has, and then register it into the system, that's possible today.
This all works over wireless as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay. There may be more to say, but we're not going to say it today. I want to thank you very much for your time and all this information, and
sure.
Hopefully a lot of people will listen to this, and grid computing will become even more popular, and maybe I'll get back to you in the next few days to talk about the California grid and how we can put that together.
Yeah, that sounds great. I appreciate your time.
Okay, I appreciate yours. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.